Welcome to Sacred Cheese of Life. This is Emma. This week, it's episode 29, which is kind of mind-blowing. Who knew I'd make it this far? I'm going to talk about Eudora Welty's short story, A Worn Path, because I really like it. There's a lot of discussion about, like, what the plot really means, and all of this, like, high school, new critical stuff that's, I think, way off target, because this is how it's usually taught, and if you look it up online, you get all of this, like, what it really means is she stands for the indomitable spirit of the South, how African-American people have recovered from abuse and terrorized by all the, and yeah, fine, if you want to be in high school, that's fine. But this story is so much more interesting than that to me. It's about, I mean, you can look up the little pricey of it. It's about an elderly African-American woman. I just looked at the Wikipedia because I was like, wait, is it Eudora Welty? Because I have no memory. It's about an elderly African-American woman who goes on a long walk through the woods to get medicine for her little sick grandson. Okay, sure. But as you read it, you don't know that. You don't know why she's going and you don't know where she's going. And to me, that's really important. It's important that we go into it not having any idea what's going on, because that's how the story's written. That's the story itself. You're out there with Phoenix, and Phoenix is walking through the woods. And that experience of going along with the character, to me, is what's so interesting. She's a profoundly unreliable narrator in that she's sort of a fantastic experiencer of the world. Like, she sees trees, and the tree is an old man reaching out to grab her. She sees a scarecrow, and to her it's not a scarecrow, it's a guy standing in a field. She, you know, she talks to the bramble bushes that grab her skirt and says, "You gotta let go of me, I have to go." You know, like, she lives in sort of, it's not quite magical realism, but it's really close to magical realism. She lives in a really magical world. She almost lives in a fairy tale world, which is important because when you're reading this, you have to know what rules to follow. And I talked about this before a little bit, probably a couple times with genre. Genre tells you what to expect, and it tells you how to read what you get. So, like, I talked about this with Connie Willis with science fiction. It's sort of science fiction because, sorry, I keep banging my footrest. One day I'll solve that problem. It's sort of science fiction in that there's a time machine. Like, if there's a time machine, it's science fiction, basically. But it's also not science fiction because it's not about that at all. That's just a, what's the word? Not a crutch. It's a tool within storytelling to make the story happen. I'm sure the word will come to me eventually. It's not important at all. What's important is the human story in that particular book. And in this, the genre, oh, I know what I have to read next, Liar by Justine Larbalestier. The story in this, she's so fabulistic in her experience of the world that you almost wonder, are we in science? Are we in fantasy? Are we in fairy tale? We don't think we're in science fiction at any point, but we think we might be in a fairy tale world because of the way she experiences the world. Also, we have no idea what the plot is as we're reading this book, which is why I think it's great not to know anything going into a story. And in fact, I tend to forbid my students from looking things up. It doesn't stop them, but I tell them don't, because it taints your experience of the story. So if you just go into this story cold, you're like, okay, Phoenix Jackson, face covered in so many wrinkles it looks like a net or a web over her face. Okay, she's extremely old. She's not very physically capable. She can't tie her shoes. That tells you a lot, right? Although I'm not sure I could tie my shoes today. I wear slip-on shoes since dislocating my shoulder. You give an inch and you never get that inch back. She can't tie her shoes, and she's going on a journey that is dangerous in the sense that, like, she crosses a bridge on a log. I mean, she crosses a creek on a log bridge and balances herself using her cane, which is made of an old umbrella. Like, that's skinny, right? That's not going to hold your weight. It's basically just enough to balance her. And at any minute, she could totally die. She gets scared and falls. And, like, there are multiple moments where she nearly dies. And she's so fragile, and yet she lives in this sort of magical world. So you're scared for her. But normally in a story, you know what you want the person to accomplish. And I guess we just want her to get where she's going and get somewhere safe where there's other people who can maybe help her if she falls down. But we don't know where she's going or why until she's almost there. And that to me is very, very interesting because it tells me a lot about the nature of storytelling. Because what are we in it for? We want people we like to get what they want, I think is generally, like if you had to boil down storytelling to its very bones, gross, it sounds like you killed storytelling and cooked it. If you had to summarize storytelling in its most essential form, it would be we want people we like to get what they want. We also want people we don't like to get what they don't want to get. Like, we want the bad people to get punished. We want the good people to be rewarded. We want to see good results for the people who we feel deserve it, bad results for the people we feel don't deserve it, etc. We want it to work out justly. We want justice. We want a just world. We know there isn't a just world because there's a whole thing called the just world fallacy, which is that you think there is a just world. So we know that doesn't exist. And it's something people use to make themselves feel better when they are doing really, really well. They're like, well, I'm doing really well because I deserve it because of a just world. And then if something bad happens, they're like, well, a bad person did it to me because that's the only way that that makes sense. I have to blame them over there. And believing in a just world is really bad for you. It means you could never be the bad guy. You could never be, you know, it's just really destructive. And so, I don't know, have a look at the just world fallacy. If you know anybody like that, which you do, that's the theory along with prosperity gospel that says, you know, if you're doing bad, it's because you deserve to do bad. If you're doing really well, it's because you deserve to do really well. Leaving aside that the way most people become, say, billionaires is by exploiting and harming other people, right? That's not good. You didn't do good to get that. You did bad to get that. So it's almost like the opposite is true, but not always, because there's TV writers who are awesome and deserve everything they get because they do great things and give us great TV. That's an example of just reward, I think. They're just the greatest. Anyway, but people who write wonderful novels are also awesome and deserve great things and they don't get it. So that's not just, is it? So, you know, just world, throw it away. So Phoenix Jackson is our example of somebody who is, she's in a story that doesn't have a plot. I would actually argue that. I would argue there is no plot because as you're reading it, you don't know what the plot is. And if we find out like the last 2-3 pages of this story, where she was going and why. And that's not a plot. It's not a plot if you don't find out while you're in it. It's not. Like, you don't know what's happening. How can you want her to get what she wants when you don't know what she wants? You can't root for her except for to survive, which I think is pretty basic. And you can't wish against anything except for against the hunter who we wish would maybe fall in a bog and never be seen again. It's just a fascinating story to me about the reading experience. Oh, here comes the kitty. Hi, kitty. So, Phoenix Jackson, she also lives in an unfair world. This is why I say it's like a fairy tale. If you're in a fairy tale, strange things are going to happen. Things are going to be sort of magical and inexplicable. And, you know, like if you're in a fairy tale, suddenly a witch will come along and demand that you answer a question or make you do a chore for her. And in response, you get something that you didn't know you needed that then you find out later on you needed. There's a dreamlike quality to it. And that's what this story shares. It shares that dreamlike quality. It really is almost like a dream you're having where you're just like walking along and you don't know what's coming next and something happens and you're like, ah, oh, it's okay. Or, oh, no. Or, oh, it's okay. Whoa, no. It doesn't follow it is linear, but it doesn't follow any sort of story logic. So there's no way to tell what's coming next. And that's unusual for a story, but it is usual for a dream or a fairy tale. So it's in a very interesting sort of genre of, I don't know, it's not linear storytelling. And I keep going back to the pilot of Deep Space Nine, which everybody should watch, because the aliens, like I'm sure I've said this before, keep telling him, a man with PTSD, that he's living in the past and it's not linear. He lives in the past. Living in the past is not linear because you're not in the past, but he does live in the past. They're not wrong. And so he's not in the present. He's unable to live in the present because of a terrible thing that happened in the past that he cannot get over. He can't get past it. So they're not wrong about that. Sisko lives in the past. This is linear in the sense that she walks a very long straight line from point A to point B. And at the end, she's going to turn around and walk back home. We don't see that part. Also, one very strange thing about the story is once we get to the end and she goes to this hospital and she asks, she checks in, you know, and the lady at the desk is like, what are you here for? And she suddenly is like, she doesn't know. She doesn't know why she's there. She has forgotten why she's there. It's almost like she's been on autopilot this whole time, like time to go to the hospital and get the thing. But then she gets there and her mind goes blank and she has no idea why she went, which is upsetting because you're like, Phoenix, you're really old. You can't hardly stand up. And you, like, she falls down at one point in the woods when a hunter's dog scares her, falls in a ditch. She cannot get out. She can't stand up. She can't crawl out of the ditch. He has to come along and hoist her out of there. And then he talks to her and he drops a nickel. She sees it. She doesn't say anything. And then he points a gun at her, just like, ha, pointing a gun at you. And she's just like, yeah, whatever. I think you're the first person who's ever pointed a gun at me. And then he leaves and she picks up the nickel. Like, and then she's like, oh no, I stole. God saw what I did. But it's just like, that doesn't add up to anything. Nothing adds up to anything. She gets to the hospital, doesn't know why. And finally, someone who remembers her comes out and is like, oh, it's Phoenix. You here to get the medicine for your grandson? And she's like, oh, yeah. That's what I'm here for. But she didn't remember up until that point. So she went on autopilot on a very dangerous journey where she could have died about 17 different times to get medicine for her little grandson. But to be able to forget that is so frightening and so alarming and also, again, so dreamlike. And it raises a lot of questions in my students who asked, day one, did he actually die? Is he actually alive? Is that why she forgot? Because she's like, wait, I don't have a grandson anymore. Because the little boy drank lye. And this is like sore throat medicine for his throat. Like, I don't think he made it. I think if he drank lye, he did not make it. And so it's like, she's like, maybe she went to get medicine for him while he was okay. And then kept going. And then when he died, she couldn't handle it and kept forgetting that he was gone, which I don't know how many really old people you know, but it's very easy for them to forget who's alive, who's dead. Because like Sisko, it's not linear. They're in the past. They live in the past in a lot of ways. I think we all do. I mean, that's all there really is. We don't have the future yet. We don't know what's going to happen. So we're living in the past. But when she remembers and she gets the medicine for her little grandson and then she takes the hunter's nickel and somebody else gives her a nickel and she takes the two of those nickels and buys a pinwheel for him. And then she also gets a lady on the street to help her tie her shoes, which is just like, you can't tie your shoes. You can't tie your shoes. That's so helpless. So then, yeah, she gets the pinwheel and then she walks on home. And that's the end of the story. So as a plot, it's nothing. But as a story, it's really interesting because one of the jokes I always tell my students, which is not actually a joke and is not funny. Anyway, the joke is, if you're ever not sure what a story is about, just say it's about life. It's about life because it is. It's always true. I mean, here we are on a journey. We don't know where we're going. Things are weird. We don't know what's happening. We might forget what we're doing and why, but you're going because here we go. One foot in front of the other, fall in a ditch, get helped out of the ditch. Some guy points a gun at you, whatever. You get scared by a scarecrow. You get scared by some tall black trees that you think are grabbing you. Like she says hello to one of these things saying, thinking it's a person and it's not a person. Like it's such a life kind of journey in the sense that you don't you don't get born with this, like, you got to do this thing. Like, there's no plot. There's no plot. We invent our plots. We're like, I'm going to get married and have a family and get a good job. And I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. I'm going to publish a bunch of books. I want to be a writer. I want to be this. I want to be a merchant marine. I want to be a Coast Guard person. I want to do a thing. We overlay our own plots, right? Which is why I think it's so interesting that she's just on this seemingly meaningless, seemingly pointless journey, and we don't know why she's going or where she's going or what the point of the journey is. And then even once we find out, it might be completely pointless because you really get the sense that this little boy is no longer among us and she's going to walk home. And I don't know, like my students always imagine things like she probably has a shelf with a whole row of these bottles on it and no grandson, you know, like. Also, where's the rest of her family? If she has a grandson, she had children, where are they? Like, we don't have any information and we don't know. And it really is like somebody you just see passing by. And I think there's a story about how the author saw somebody walking along the Natchez Trace and just got this idea for this story. And again, calling it a story is kind of loose because there's no plot. There's literally no plot. I'm going to go for a long walk is not a plot. It's really not. Like, that's just not, there's no plot there. And yet it's a compelling thing to read because we like Phoenix. She's funny. She laughs at her own inability to do things. She talks to everything around her. I find her very appealing. Very appealing. And also I'm worried about her because she doesn't seem to have the physical ability to accomplish the goal she set out for herself. So that's upsetting. But I'm also thinking in a larger sense about storytelling and life, like just telling somebody's life and how boring that can be. Like, I find biography excruciatingly boring because there's no plot. Even if it's somebody who went on and did something amazing, or, you know, VH1 Behind the Music, rose to fame and then fell into drug addiction and then recovered and went on to da-da-da-da. It's not a plot. Those are some events. Again, we're in fairy tale land. We're in this sort of A, then B, then C storytelling, and not the crucial thing of a plot, which is A causes B, causes C. And the whole, like, characters have to make choices when they face conflicts. And then there's consequences, and they have to figure out how to recover from the consequences. And then they face more conflicts, and they make choices. Like, that can happen in your life, sure, but life is not the same as a plot. It's really not. And as I'm writing things, I'm always wondering, like, yes, it's easy to write the plot that, or the non-plot of life, where they're just like living and stuff happens and they do stuff and they recover and they make another plan, and it's not a plot. And it is very boring, to me at least, to read. And like I said, biography is excruciating. I just don't get the point. And I was looking at this autobiography sort of thing that I was developing out of my old blog from way back when I was moving to Los Angeles. I had a plan. See, there's a plot to it. And the plot is I was going to go be a TV writer because I love TV writing so much. It's the most interesting thing. And I wanted to do it. And I had wanted to do it for years and years and years. Got diverted by other things, got thwarted, etc. And then I was going to go. And so I went. And so even as I'm reading it, I'm like, oh, dude, you're so hopeful and it's just not going to work out. So there's a plot. There's something you want. You want this person to accomplish something because reading it is very fun. And I mean, I wrote it, but it was so long ago, I might as well have been somebody else. It's fun to read. This person is excited by life, enjoys things. See, it's a lot like Phoenix, where I'm like, oh, you don't have the skills to do this because you have some emotional problems. You have severe anxiety, etc. No support. And as somebody else online and I were just talking about this, how if you're raised by someone emotionally abusive, you hear criticism constantly, even in your own head. Everything is criticism all around you. Like red light, you hit the red light when you're late and you're like, well, it's my fault because I screwed up because I did. You can't stop it because it's what is wired into your brain. Maybe you can if you have a lot of, you know, CBT, etc., training, therapy, but I've never had that. And I just have to fight it on my own. And we were talking about how you fight it by going, I wouldn't take your advice on lunch. I wouldn't take your advice on which bagel to get. So shut the hell up. Like, you have to tell it to shut up, which, I mean, obviously it comes from a specific person. That tends to be the voice you hear. And you have to fight it all the time. But anyways, I'm reading this thing. I'm like, you were raised by an emotionally abusive person. You are full of this criticism. You've been so criticized. It's like your brain is tattooed with it. You don't have that confidence. And when you don't have that confidence, it's very hard to put yourself out there and feel okay when it doesn't work out. Instead, you tend to feel destroyed and like it was your fault, right? Like I just said. And so it's fun to read, but at the same time, like, it's pretty clear this person doesn't have the emotional strength, and like all the enthusiasm and good cheer in the world won't get you through when you can't handle criticism because you've been nothing but criticized forever. And you can't handle vulnerability because any vulnerability immediately was jumped on and attacked, right? Anything you admitted was used against you. Anything, like, it's, I don't know. You can go read the story collection, The Worst, if you want to know what that was like. Although that doesn't even get into it really as much. There's some of it in there, but like the constant drumbeat of criticism, so bad for you. So like reading that, I'm like, yay, there's a plot and yay, I'm excited for it. But oh, it's going to be such a bummer when we see how it burns up. And it really does crash and burn, although that's for health reasons. Story is hard, but a character who you like, and maybe that's just the essence of tragedy, is when you see somebody trying to do something and you're like, oh, you don't have what it takes. I mean, we really are in like Macbeth territory. Like, I know you want to do it and I want you to do it, but you're gonna bomb because you don't have the emotional, like, you don't have a, they always say, like, a foundation, right? Like, there's no foundation. This isn't even built on sand. This is built on pudding. There's nothing to stand on. There's nothing. And that gets you on every level. Like, going to make a cup of tea is so fraught with peril for me. Like, I'm going to screw it up. I'm going to wreck it. I'm going to forget the kettle's on. I'm going to burn the house down. You don't understand how deep it goes unless you understand how deep it goes. Like my friend Claire. Oh, it's awful. So even, and today, just today, I dropped a whole bowl of noodles on the floor because I forgot I had it in my hand. And it tipped and burned my thumb and I dropped it upside down and there's noodles everywhere. But don't worry, the dog and I cleaned it up. I put them into a bowl again and let them cool. And then she got to have them when they were cool. And I made myself another bowl. But like every mistake, you're like, that's because I'm terrible. See what I mean? Anyway, I should write something about that. Well, I mean, I am. I'm writing 40-40 about that. She's got that in her. Anyway, so Phoenix Jackson and it's biography. The pointlessness of biography is just really on my mind. It has to have a goal or else you're just like, yeah, it's a person being alive. Why am I reading this? I mean, people are great and interesting and fascinating and I do want to know, but I also kind of don't care if there's no story going on. Like, what are they trying to do? I'm going to talk about writing now. Okay, so beep. If you're sick of hearing me talk about writing, this is a good place to jump off. I haven't been writing it, but I've been thinking about 40-40 nonstop. I haven't been writing since one day I went way off the rails with it and I wrote a bunch of garbage. And this is the same thing that happens with upholstery. Like, if I do something wrong, I'm like, ugh. And then I don't want to go back to it because looking at my own mistakes is very upsetting for me. See above RE. Drumbeat of criticism. Anyway, you're not allowed to screw up because if you screw up, then they're right. See what I mean? Anyway, I did finally yesterday undo some couch stuff that needed to get fixed. I'm reupholstering a love seat. It's not even a big project. Ugh. Anyway, I did a lot of it And that's amazing. And I felt really good about it, except for the extreme pain in my back, which is debilitating. Debilitating. And I need to see a specialist because I can't walk, move. Like, I couldn't lift an arm to turn on a light switch. That's how bad my upper back hurt. And I don't think it should be like that. I really don't. Whether you've upholstered or not. Anyway, I was upholstering instead of writing because the writing is in the same position where I wrote this garbage stuff and I have to go back and look at it and delete it, which I don't want to do. You hate to do that, but it's garbage and it has to go. Like, it went the wrong direction. Hi, kitty. And I did realize the right direction. I realized the whole key to 40-40 after writing the garbage, and that's awesome. So sometimes you just got to do it wrong in order to figure out how to do it right. Today is brought to you by my cat, Eleanor, who is yelling. Eleanor, are you yelling? Yeah, you are. Anyway, the love seat and the book were in the same position. I have been writing it until I wrote the garbage and stopped, but I know what to do next, and I also know what to do next for the love seat. The love seat. The arms of it, you have to cut these weird teardrop shapes to sew onto the top corner of the arm cover. And it's like mental math that is 3D, and I did it wrong. And so I had to rip out 10,000 tiny stitches that were invisible because the thread matches the fabric. Set me back. So only one arm is upholstered. But one arm is upholstered. Yay! I'm trying to get it done before my sister gets here. So I'm not writing as much as I should because I'm doing these other things. And it turned the house from, you know, a nice house into, like, an upholstery store exploded. Like, there's foam and tools and fabric, and the old fabric that I'm using as templates, and thread and needles. And I had to use these curvy needles, curvy half circle needles that are so cool. And I always imagine, like, post-apocalyptically, I'll have to sew up my own wound. I don't know how I'm getting wounded, although I get wounded every day, with, like, sanitized dental floss, or monofilament would be better because it doesn't have pores. Monofilament, also sanitized. Like, I can tie a knot with monofilament. Like, I can, I mean, I know I pierced my own nose with a needle. I suppose I could sew something up, but let's not do any of that. Let's not have an apocalypse to start with. Hello. Anyway, I have a curved needle in case we need it. I have two. I have four. I have two packs. There's two in each. I'm ready. I'm not ready emotionally, though. Again, please let's skip the apocalypse. Anyway, book. I know what needs to happen. I know that she has to go to this therapist who's like, oh, dude, you are severely high risk because you were a foster kid and you don't have family support. You don't have, she doesn't have anybody. She doesn't have, like, extended family or anybody. She literally had a wonderful therapist who died, and she has her old therapist's brother who's this messed up. He was driving. Maybe she was driving. I'm not sure. His sister, I don't know. He got severely injured and his leg doesn't work anymore. And he's a painter and she's always over there. And it's not a good situation for her in terms of moving on or healthy relationships. Not that he's a problem. He's just super damaged on his own. But she doesn't have anybody. And so the therapist is like, I need you to do these things. And one of these things is don't do these things for the first 6 weeks. And that's what's going to set it up. That's why it's 40 days and 40 nights. Six, I think it is. Don't ask me. So that's great. I figured out why it's called that and how that's going to drive things. And it successfully eliminates all the garbage, stupidity. And it gives you this really wonderful relationship between her and Zeke, which is what I want the whole thing to be about. It's what it started with, was the relationship between her and Zeke, and why it can't happen until it can happen, which gives them time to get over some major psychological obstacles. Just, you got to get through some of this stuff before you can get to the good stuff, and that's some of the things they have to do. Anyway, it's working. It's working and it's working and it's working. And that makes me really happy. And it would work better if I would write it than just think about it. But I think about it all day, every day, all day, every day. Even when I'm listening to endless episodes of My Favorite Murder while I'm upholstering a couch. That's what's been going on. It has to happen. I'm in love with the book 40-40. There's a lot of problematic stuff in it that has to get rewritten? When is that ever not the case? There's a lot of stuff that's missing. Like, they have to do a short film a week, which is insane, but that's the goal. Like, it's really just a scene, you know, a scene or two or three. Their professor can make whatever limitations. Making people, I used to assign storyboards this way, like, tell me a story in three frames. And then they're like, oh no, because they want to tell a story in 100 frames. But in a storyboard, if you can tell me a story in three frames, you're doing great. And they used to do great stuff with it. Oh, they were so good. They would tell really quick little stories. Like, and I always think of there's a comic where the last frame is always someone going, oh no, these little curvy shaped people, like they almost look like hand puppet shape, like just a blob for an arm, a blob for a head, and a blob for another arm. And they're always going, oh no, I can't remember the name of it or anything. But something happens, and then something else happens, and then they go, oh no. Because it's always like, I think it's a good thing. Uh-oh. Oh no. Which, you can tell amazing stories in little frames like that. And making students storyboard really made them tell visual stories. And it really made them not just write a bunch of garbage. Like, I don't know, me. Like, if you are forced to draw me some pictures to show me your story, you will write a better story, because it really makes you not go hand wavy. You can't hand wave. You have to turn something in, and it has to be images, and it has to be on these pieces of paper that I passed out with three squares in a row, you know. And then they're like, but I want to make it bigger. So make it bigger, do whatever, just make it three squares in a row. I don't care. And then they came up with such good stuff. Man, I miss teaching that stuff, because I learned a lot. And I mean, if you had to draw a worn path in a storyboard, it's just such an interesting exercise. Like, what's frame one? Old woman walking through the woods, teetering, right? And we know there's all these episodes where she crosses the thing and she da-da-da and meets the scarecrow and there's the old corn. There's so many images of death in this story that you can't even count them. Like, we tried one time, we tried listing them all on the board, and they just went on and on and on. Like, she sees a gallows, she sees something that she thinks is a dead man's hand grabbing her coat. Like, all of these things, you know, the scarecrow she thinks is a dead person. Like, just, and she falls in the ditch, the guy points a gun at her, the black dog, the students always point out the black dog. Since Harry Potter, they're like, image of death, which, I mean, it was long before that, but they didn't know it until they learned it from Harry Potter. And just endless, endless images of death. And so, like, you'd have to sort of condense them visually or something. But she goes past all those images of death and then ends up at a hospital, which is also interesting. So, like, what squares would you use? So maybe you put in square one, there's Phoenix facing images of death. Maybe you just break it down so there's just the gallows or something. And then what's the second one? Like, maybe the second one is her at the arriving at the hospital. And the third one is her with her head all blank. I don't know. Because turning around and going back home isn't really part of the story. To me, the story is about overcoming all these obstacles, surviving, persevering, making it all the way there, and then going, oh, wait, what's it all for? Like, it's almost an existential story to me. It's such a strange little story. I hope you all go read it, because it really throws you for a loop. Like, wait, hi, kitty. It's a strange little story because things happen, but they happen in an episodic way where they don't further a story. We know this, right? Like, episodic in the sense of A plus B plus C plus D, not in the sense of A, therefore B, therefore C, therefore D. Episodic in the sense of, like we were talking about with Poker Face, where what happens in one episode does not affect anything in the next episode. It's just another episode. So episodic in the sense of these things happen to Phoenix, but there's no consequences and there's no furthering of the action and there's no development. It's not a story. It's not a story. A story has to drive the next thing. Everything that happens should drive the next thing. Otherwise, yeah, we're in episodic. And I was thinking about this even more lately with like Wonderfalls I was thinking about. And I was thinking about how Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is, I'm still watching that terrible season because it's next. And I haven't actually had it on lately, but like it's non-episodic in the sense that what happened, it's serialized. It's what happens matters and drives the next episode. So you kind of have to see every episode in order to understand what's going on. And that to me is what novels are. But short stories should also be that way. What happens should matter to what happens next. And it doesn't. It doesn't. It does not. It doesn't affect anything about the end. It really doesn't. At least for the characters. For us, it kind of does because we're like, how are you still alive? How are you still alive? She starts to feel a little miraculous. How are you still alive when all these terrible things keep almost happening or do happen? Like, it's no joke to have a guy point a gun at you in the middle of the woods all alone. If he's a crazy guy or just feels like killing somebody, he'll just kill her. And no consequences. Nobody's there. Nobody's going to know it's him. There's no evidence tying him to her. Do you know? Like, it's just, it's terrifying. And but she faces that threat to herself just like she faces all the other threats to her life. She's just like, okay, I'm going to keep going. Which is, like, it's about her character and it's not about her story. It's just really interesting. It's such a weird story. And I really enjoy how the students tackle it because they do this thing my friend and I were talking about years ago, how narrative is so much more complex these days that students who are young come to it thinking it's more complex than it is. So they will read levels and levels into everything without regard to whether it's there or not, which I mean, that's welcome to the postmodern world. You can, you do, you are, you will. It's there whether it's there or not. It's, if you read it that way, it's there. That's fine. My new class starts tomorrow, so we get to talk about that again. I love my class. I used to teach all different classes, but now I just teach the one over and over and over, which is fine. It doesn't matter. But it is a little bit like, again, episodic. Like, it doesn't add up to anything, but that's in the nature of teaching anyway. It's never the same. Well, rarely. It's rarely the same people twice. They don't build on what you gave them before because it's different people. It's fine. It's how it is. There, sorry, I had to drink my throat coat tea because I'm all sore throaty from no doubt upholstery dust. I'm having a problem, okay? I'm having a physical meltdown on three different fronts. It's not great. All right, but we'll solve it. Phoenix Jackson got through and so can I. Anyway, throat coat tea, very good. Here comes the dog. Is it later than I think? Oh, it is later than I think. All right, I have to go walk my dog. A worn path. I don't know. I have to think more about it because writing any book about any character is like, I mean, you always have to ask yourself, so what? Why do we care? Why do we care if a character gets what they want or doesn't get what they want? Why do we care if they're having a tough time? Why do we care, especially if their problems are internal or emotional? Why do we care how they overcome it? Why do we care? And Phoenix Jackson, I'm petting my dog. Phoenix Jackson is an example of why we care. We care because she has this indomitable spirit, because she's going through these ridiculous challenges and coming out okay. And we love to see that. I love to see that. I think that's very appealing when someone's like, and I just keep going back to Buffy. Once again, Buffy is in this episode because terrible things kept happening in that show, right? Everything was terrible all the time. But those kids joked about it. And they weren't joking because they didn't understand it. They were joking because that's the only way you keep from screaming sometimes. You gotta joke. And I think that's a really good way for people to cope and to be likable. Both. So if they can joke about it, they know how bad it is. But, you know, like, what's the one episode where someone's like, I think maybe Giles is like, it's the end of the world, apocalypse. And they're like, again? Like, it makes me laugh every time I think of it. Again? Because yes, it was. And yes, again, like it just keeps coming at them. They keep having to deal with overwhelmingly awful things. And they're still joking and you know, looking out for each other, and they still want to have a good life, and they just keep coming. They just keep fighting. When they get knocked down and they fight again. And that's amazing. And I think appealing characters are like that. And Phoenix Jackson is like that. And people who feel sorry for themselves are not like that. And so that's very important to avoid that in characters. Like, they can't be mopey. They can't be, you know, down on themselves. Or you're like, especially down on themselves, because you're like, if you don't even like yourself, why would I like you? I don't think I tend to write characters like that, but they do tend to be going through a lot of bad stuff. And sometimes, quite often, they're freaking out about it. I don't mind freaking out. I don't like people being down on themselves. I think that's one of the least appealing things. We do tend to agree. If someone's like, I'm the worst, you're like, oh, are you? Oh, well, then I might go hang out with somebody else, because I don't want to hang out with the worst. And you would know. And it is, of course, a rhetorical move people make, like, please tell me I'm not the worst. But we do tend to believe people when they say they're the worst. We don't believe them when they say they're the best, though. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. So sense of humor and Phoenix Jackson and just keeping going when things are rough. And yeah, I am thinking about The Nerve lately. Of course, I read it recently to get it published, and I have a proof. I need to read it again. Those characters are, they're in a bad spot. We've got Ariel and Carlisle are in a bad position. They have bad parent stuff going on. No way, in my book. And they don't know how to solve it. And there's a spot where Ariel doesn't answer the phone when her mom calls, and she's not allowed to do that. Like, she is under her thumb. And so for the first time, she just lets it go to voicemail. And then she doesn't answer it the next time either, and she doesn't answer it the next time either. And she just stops letting it happen. She stops the banter, the hectoring and the constant control and all this stuff. She just stops it. And then, of course, her mother escalates and, like, repossesses her car and all this stuff, and tries to force her to drop out of college. That happened to me. They succeeded, though, because she wouldn't fall in line. And by fall in line, I just mean, like, answer the phone and do what they say. Answer the phone and do what they say. Like, you have to be within my control or I will escalate. Ariel doesn't get bummed about it. She's really busy doing something else. She's so busy making this thing. She's busy making this thing that ultimately solves the problem. But she starts with that one step. Stop answering the phone. Do you read Captain Awkward? Because I read Captain Awkward. And she just wrote this really good response to a letter from a person who was like, I'm the worst and my emotional problems are making my relationship not work out. And here's what happens. And then she tells this story of how her girlfriend is so controlling and so awful. And, like, for her girlfriend's birthday, she makes her a fancy cake. Like, she asks her what she wants. What do you want for your birthday? And she's like, I want this cake and I want this for a present. And that's what I want. And so she does that for her birthday. And then the girlfriend has a cow, like, pitches a fit because she didn't get coffee in bed, which she did not ask for. She did not request. When the beleaguered girlfriend asked what she wanted for her birthday, she didn't ask for that. This is a person who wants to be angry, and wants to be angry because that lets her control the other person. And it's so ugly, and it's so awful, and it is what a controlling person is like. And that's what Claire and I were talking about. Like, how I used to joke, and I mean, like, in my 20s, that I was going to get a t-shirt that said, you're doing it wrong, so that my mom could see it, because all she ever said to me was, you're doing it wrong, you're doing it wrong, you're doing it wrong, you're doing it wrong. And I mean, my whole life long. And it's just, it's funny, but it's not really funny. But she heard the same thing, Claire, the same thing her whole life long. You're doing it wrong, you're doing it wrong, you're doing it wrong. And we were talking about how doing the dishes was always a point where they would come in and be like, you're doing it wrong. Don't do it like that. You're doing it wrong. And again, you're not. It's the dishes. It's fine. Are they clean? It's fine. There's not really a lot of ways to do the dishes wrong if the dishes get clean, right? Like, they get clean, you did it right. But both of us had this experience, and you could see it easily happening with Ariel and her mom. You're doing it wrong. Because then they get to get mad. And once they are allowed to be mad, they get to do whatever, right? They want that permission to be mad. And just reading that Captain Awkward, which I highly recommend, it was just like so crystal clear. And of course, it's crystal clear to us in retrospect that they're being critical about things that don't deserve criticism, because then they get to be mad. And when they're mad, they get to be in control. And that's so gross. I need to think a lot more about that and maybe try to find a text where that happens besides my collected works. Yeah, like being super critical, picking out something that's not actually wrong and freaking out about it. Like, man, that woman who asked for the right cake, asked for the present, did not ask for coffee in bed, and then pitched a fit and ruined the entire day, refused to go to her birthday dinner, etc., because she didn't get coffee in bed when she didn't ask for it. And she was specifically asked what she wanted. And I was like, wow, story of my life. You cannot win. You can never win. You can't be allowed to win. Even if you do everything right, they will find a way to make it so you did something wrong. You're doing it wrong. Holy goodness. Anyway, off track for a worn path, but just very, very interesting with that kind of like, and there's no way to win except for just to get out of it. You cannot stop those people. You really can't. You can't stop a controlling person. You just have to get out of their control. Yeah. And as I was reading The Nerve, I was like, yeah, that moment when she doesn't answer the phone, it's like the end of the world. Like, she broke the contract. The contract is, I say jump and you jump. And if you don't jump, oh no. Because they don't actually have that control, and you're telling them they don't have that control. And to them, that is the end of the world. Like, they lose their minds and they will escalate. You just got to get out of it. Get out of it. Get away. So anyway, need to write more about that. Maybe in 4040. I also added a really cool protection character. Remember how in Alien, you know, you have Ripley and she has the cat Jonesy and you're like, save the cat. And then in Aliens, there's a little girl she has to save and take care of. And also that boy, that cute boy. What's his name? Can't remember his name. Who's also in Terminator? Who's that guy? He was like the cute guy of the 80s. Anyway, she has someone to protect. And when you can really escalate the stakes when someone's not just trying to survive for themselves, but is trying to protect someone else. And so I've done that. I've got her grandmother, who's under the mother's control, the abusive mother's control, and I had originally written it that she was worse. She was worse than the mother. And she's the one who made the mother the way she was. But then I was like, wait, no, don't do that. Make it so that the grandmother who got sick is now under the mother's control. Because this person is awful. She's going to be awful to other people besides just her kid. So now she has to rescue the grandmother, which really ups the stakes, because before it was just like, how do I deal with this awful person who wants me back in their life so that they can control me? No. And now I'm like, well, okay, now you have to interact with her because you have to rescue this poor old lady who's sick, who's under this awful person's control, who's been abusing her and keeping her, you know, like not in good conditions, etc. So that's going to make it much better, much better, so much better. It's also much better when someone's trying to save someone else than when they're just saving themselves. Just narratively, it's stronger. It's less self-absorbed. It's less, what, I don't know, self-serving. It's just, it's more interesting. It's more sympathetic when they're saving someone else. Newt, that little girl, Newt. Okay, so that's the writing. That's the reading. If you haven't read along A Worn Path, I recommend it. It's like a 5-minute read, maybe 8. Kitty's on a rampage. Next week, I'm going to read Liar by Justine Larbalestier. I'm sure it's available in ebook. I know it's out of print in paperback, but it's readily accessible. Libraries have it. It's so good. It made the students irate. There's a point. Is it like going into, is it in four parts, I think? Three parts, four parts? Going into the last part, they would come to class and just be like, "What is happening? Why did you make me read this? I can't stand this. What? I have to finish this book." Or they would come in and go, "I had to finish. I couldn't stop. It was making me crazy. I had to, this book is maddening." It's very, very good. And I never write a really unreliable narrator, and now I want to. Oh no, now I really want to. I never do. I write trustworthy narrators. And I didn't even talk much about Phoenix Jackson as an unreliable narrator. A little bit. But I'll talk more about it next week with Liar. So Liar is about a liar. She starts out and says, "I'm a liar, but I'm telling the truth now." And then she tells you the truth. And then a little while later, she tells you some stuff that contradicts that. And she's like, "Well, yeah, okay, I lied about that one thing, but I'm telling the truth now." And this is why it makes the students insane, because they're like, "I don't know what to trust." And I'm like, "I know. Unreliable narrators are one of my favorite things ever. I love unreliable narrators. Takes a lot of memory, though. And obviously, I can't remember. I have a bowl of soup in my hand. So, might be tricky for me to write. But it would be so worth doing. Anyway, Liar, Justine Larbalestier. It's called Liar. You can't mix it up with anything else. It has a green cover. I have had students throw this across the room. That's how frustrated they get. But to me, that's a good thing because it makes you question your reading. Because we are often so unconsciously trusting as we read, and I don't think that's the way to go. I think you want to question things. It makes them into awake, alert, aware readers. And I think that's what they need to be. You can always just, turn that off later and go read Murderbot for the 20th time. Okay, that's it. Go read The Nerve if you want a good book, because it is a good book and I like it a lot. And I think it's $3.99 ebook or something like that. The Nerve, such a good book. Good times. And there's that moment where Ariel stops answering her mom's phone calls. And it's just the biggest moment of power in the life of a young person who has been under this person's thumb unrelentingly her entire existence. She has a theory that's because she's away, she's out of town when it happens, and it's like her mom is like a radio frequency, and the further away you get, the less powerful it is, which I thought was very funny. I know I'm laughing at my own joke, but I wrote it a long time ago, so it doesn't count. The distance does not hurt, but it doesn't always help either because you internalize this stuff. Okay, so that's a good thing to read. Read Liar. Liar is so much fun. Please read Liar and let me know. Like, if you have to choose, read Liar over The Nerve. Liar is so much fun. It messes with your head so much. And the moment when you get really mad is like, oh, I can't tell you. But I am going to give away the ending, and you need to read it before I give it away. So please read. I will talk to you next time. If you have questions, comments, concerns, email me at sacredcheesepodcast@gmail.com. Oh, I added a link. Not a link. I added a new tab to the top bar of my website, which is podcast notes, which is where I'm going to start putting things instead of that link to the old blog place, Blogspot, or whatever it is, because it's silly to go off site. I want everything in one place. So I'm going to be using that instead. Have a look there. It's right next to the podcast on the website. It's just to the right of it. It says podcast notes. So that's where you can go. And that is it. Thank you for listening. Sacred Cheese of Life.